Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, this is Anna, and I have a favor to ask you. I know a lot about you from the emails, tweets, and Facebook comments you share with us. I really do feel like I know you, but I could know you better. So will you fill out a survey for me and tell us more about how you listen to podcasts, what your other favorite podcasts are? It will help us and WNYC, the station we work for, make sure we're giving you more of what you want. Go to WNYC.org/participate to take the survey or find the link at deathsexmoney.org. This is Death, Sex, and Money, the show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale, and this episode was recorded live in Brooklyn in front of a sold-out crowd earlier this month. Thank you so much for being here tonight. I'm so glad to have us all here together at Radio Love Fest here at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, partnership with WNYC, listener-supported public radio. And tonight, we're going to look at big changes in life and the people and things that help us through. Often when we're going through all sorts of transition, family can be the one constant. Our guests tonight are two cousins, a mother and a son, and a husband and wife. The married couple are Amatus, a musician, and her husband, actor Mahershala Ali. You know Mahershala from House of Cards, from Hunger Games. They've been married for 3 years, but they've actually known each other for nearly 20 since they were acting students together at NYU. Comedian Hari Kondabolu is also here with his mother, Uma Kondabolu. And I am so excited that she is here with us because we all know, no matter how much we think we have grown and changed, our mothers point out that we're acting the same way we did when we were 5 years old. Also here tonight, the singer Lisa Fisher and her band, Grand Baton. They are our house band tonight. Welcome. Our first guests are Rosie Perez and her cousin, Sixto Ramos. Woo! We all know Rosie from her breakout performance in Do the Right Thing. She was nominated for an Oscar for her role in the movie Fearless, nominated for multiple Emmys for her choreography on In Living Color. She's from Brooklyn. She's got family throughout this borough. And her cousin, Sixto, is also an actor. He hosts a weekly radio show called Say It with Sixto Ramos. And they actually did not know they were related when they first worked together on the set of Do the Right Thing. We're going to talk about that and what's pulled them together closer in these last couple of years. Please welcome Rosie Perez and Sixto Ramos. Tell me about how you first met Sixto as an adult, and then when you realized you were blood.
Well, it was on the set of Do the Right Thing. I am a love child, meaning I'm a product. That's funny. Okay. I guess it's more common these days. So one of my half-sisters on my mother's side was down on the set of Do the Right Thing, and she had a crush on one of the actors named Angel. And Angel and her were going to go on a date, but she was afraid, so she asked me to double. And I said, but who am I doubling with? And she said, oh, his friend, Sixto Ramos. And I said, oh, Sixto, I know that name. I have a relative named Sixto. It's not him. And I said, no, I swear, who is he? And she pointed him out, and I went, oh, hell no, 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 no. Something's not right. So I called my aunt, and I asked her, I said, Tia, do I have a relative named Sixto Ramos? Yes, you do. You used to take baths with him when you were little. And I told my half-sister, I said, I almost went on a date with my cousin. That's so sick. That's so disgusting. And then And then he's a little clueless because he still didn't realize we were cousins. I guess he didn't get the memo.
Nobody told me.
Yeah, and so all this time, you know, and
I would literally see Rosie walking by. Hey, what's up? Hey, how you doing? We would walk right by each other like that until she came down to see I was doing a show with John Leguizamo, and she came and she goes, hey, and we spoke, and then we started from there.
And at that point, so Rosie, your career sort of takes off after Do the Right Thing. Sixto, you become a parent soon after to two twins.
Yes.
Who are now in their 20s.
Yes.
So was there a lot that you could connect around when your lives were taking pretty different shapes?
Well, yes, because I'm hilarious and he's just kind of funny.
I taught her everything. She knows the funny. Let me just say my part, you know, like I feel that Rosie and I have connected not only through mutual friends but family. I'm not that kind of guy that says, oh, that's my cousin if that's not my cousin. You know, that's my cousin, and I know her father, and I grew up watching her father, and so I knew. And it's important to me. I don't know. There was some kind of friendship thing that we bonded, and we love boxing.
And we love boxing, and what's funny is that my father saw us, Sixto and I, hanging out together one day, and he started laughing, and then he started tearing up, and I said, why are you crying? And he says, it reminds me of my friendship with his mother, because my father and his mother are first cousins, so we're second cousins. And I said, really? He goes, I went, oh, that's right, because my father was best friends with his mother. So it was just kind of... It just was weird. It's like if you believe in any of that stuff, it was real for us. But when we first started to really get to know each other, he irritated the hell out of me.
She wasn't easy.
He was. And we used to fight a lot. And from the fighting is actually what brought us closer. And we started becoming friends. But Sixto is correct. It really circled around boxing. Because a lot of times I would watch boxing by myself because, you know, a lot of, you know, my female friends were like, I can't believe you watched that. That's disgusting. I said, you don't understand it. If you don't understand it, I can see how you can view it. And Sixto would call me, what are you doing? I'm watching boxing. Me too! And so we would actually stay on the phone the entire fight.
You wouldn't go to the same place. You'd just stay on the phone.
Sometimes he would come over, but sometimes I would be in L.A. and he's in New York.
And we're on the phone. I go, oh my God, did you see that? Yeah, I saw that. I'm the guy beating the shit out of you. That's me. I'm beating you up.
Sixto, you're not supposed to curse.
I told him. It's cool.
I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's cool. So I want to go back, Rosie. You said that you could feel this sense of history together, even though you actually hadn't had that when you were growing up. But you did say you fought a lot initially. What would you fight about?
That's a good question. I don't even remember. What do we fight about?
Just pure nonsense, if you ask me.
Yeah.
I got to tell you. It was almost like we were sizing each other up, like, you know, she's this Puerto Rican girl, I'm this Puerto Rican guy, we knew we were cousins, we just met, we're looking, yeah, what do you want, what do you want, what's going on? You know, we were both, like, looking for friendship and probably that family thing, but we were both sizing each other up. You know, nobody wants to get hurt. Nobody wants to get hurt. Everybody wants to be family, and we went through a lot of stuff in my life and her life, so we were guarded, and that love grew, but it took years. Like, we really, like, people say, oh, Rosie's your sister, right? And I go, yeah, it feels like that.
Yeah, you know? It feels like that. And we can fight till dawn.
She never says she's sorry, but this is what she'll do. She'll go, what are you doing? Yeah. She goes, I'm cooking something. I go, okay, I'll be over, and we watch the fight by ourselves.
That is true. I don't apologize. He's right.
He doesn't apologize.
Only to him. I don't know why. I won't apologize to him.
I'm cooking, and I go, mm-hmm.
You know, I think that it's very rare, especially in this very crazy time that we're having where there's so much hate all around. There's one thing that we did fight for our friendship. We fought for our blood tie. To be real. And so even though we do fight, no one can come between this. And I mean no one.
One day Rosie had a fight or something, her and I, and then I said, I'm your family, I'm your cousin. She goes, but I'm your friend too. She goes, I'm your friend. And I you know, that still sticks in my head that she says, you're like one of my best friends. I was like, Oh, my God.
He cried like a bitch. Oh, my God.
I was like, this is crazy.
I'm interested in sort of the way your friendship has changed over the course of your adulthood. Rosie, in 1999, you lost your mother to AIDS. Your father died in 2009. Your tia, who helped raise you, has passed. Has losing those people made you kind of hold closer to the family you have?
Oh, most definitely. And it was funny. There was this one very dramatic fight that Sixto and I were having, and he started screaming in my kitchen, "When everyone's gone, I'm the only one that will be standing here." And I said, "Oh, and cut." You know?
Yeah. And I said, "Should
cameras
I go back
are not
and
rolling.
Do that again?"
You know, and it proved itself to be true, because during those times I had my sister Carmen with me, and I had, you know, other family around me that were very supportive, but it was different. He would call every day. He would come over every day. He kept bringing me pastries, which irritated the hell out of me, and because they were good. And you know, and he just wouldn't stop.
I could honestly say 100% that although we bicker sometimes, she'll call me at 3 a.m. I'm in the car,
and he'll come. He will come. And the same here, because when your father passed away and your mom passed away, it was the same thing.
Yeah, she was there. I called her and I said, "My mom passed away," and I was crying. And she goes, "I'm right there." And she was there in a half hour from the other side of Brooklyn. And I remember that.
Oh. I want to ask about your dog.
Yeah.
The one that raped him?
Not that dog. Not that I know of.
What? That happened a long time ago. And he just grabbed me from the back. Oh, I was like, "What the hell?" And I tried to get him off me. He was like, "Oh." I just stood there and I was like, "Oh my God. Help. Help. God damn, somebody help me. This dog was all over me. Ah."
That wasn't the dog I was asking about.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry. The dog I was talking about is your dog who you lost last year.
Yeah, Big Red.
Oh, Big Red.
Yeah.
Who was a really important part of your life.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. He was with me 11 years. He was such a great dog. And when he was sick and he just kept getting worse, and one day Dr. Hollander called me and he said, "Sixto, you know, when are you going to stop being selfish? Red is really sick. He's not going to get better." And, you know, so we had to let Red go, and that really hurt me. I had no idea how much you could love an animal like that. I cried more than I cried for human people. I was like, "Oh, my God, I have him home still. I talk to him every now and then. Hey, Red. Then I go, "God, I went crazy. I'm talking to a box." Yeah. I'm talking to a box.
Excuse me, but did he answer your question?
He did answer my question.
Okay.
What? I'm sorry.
And I want to know, Rosie, was that a period when Sixto was saying goodbye to Red? Was that another time when you were
doing the call-ins and the check-ins? She came over, and that's the thing that's when you know. That's when it counts, right? When you're down like that and you're feeling lonely, and I said, "Hey, Rose, you know, Red passed." I said, "And she goes, I'm coming over." I said, no, you don't have to. You don't have to." Boom, she was there.
Thank you, Sixto Ramos, for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having
us. Hearing about your family.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So it's almost spring here in New York City. We're leaping forward tonight. Our long winter of dark afternoons is almost over. I spent a lot of time in my apartment this winter hibernating and incubating and thinking about all the things that are getting ready to change in my life. And I have to say, something that really helped me get out of my head was the music that you shared with me. I asked Death, Sex, and Money listeners to share the songs that have been important to them during moments of change in their lives. And we collected a playlist of more than 600 songs that I've just been playing on shuffle in my apartment. And not only the songs, but I also heard the stories of what people were going through when this particular song was important to them. And then some of you sent in dance videos.
Hi, Anna. I'm going through some transitions.
I have a lot of uncertainty in my life.
Big changes.
And part of what got me through was music.
We got married a year and a half ago, and now we're getting a divorce. I like Mary Lambert's song, Secrets, so damn much because growing up in the South, we were always taught not to air out your dirty laundry.
Is dysfunctional, but we have a good time killing.
My sister and I used to have dance parties all the time growing up, and we've actually started doing them again since I've lived here, and life has been so upside down.
Well, I'm over it.
In the summer of 2013, that was probably the first time in my life that I was like physically just debilitated by depression. I struggled to get out of bed every single day. So that summer, when I would go to work in the morning, that'd be the first song on my list was Good Ass Intro. It's a very optimistic song. It gave me, you know, these sort of mantras.
I just kept on playing it because it just kept on saying, don't give up, don't give up.
I see the song as representative of a big change in my life.
I owe him and that song a lot. I really do.
My husband was incarcerated a few years ago, and I was left with a three-year-old. And I lived in his mother's basement with my daughter. And every weekend, we would travel to my mother's house to get away. We would sing this song back and forth for about a year.
I'm taking my freedom, putting it in my car. Wherever I choose to go, it won't take me far. I'm living my life like it's golden, living my life like it's golden.
My name is David. Being a gay man and being an undocumented immigrant for a big part of my life, I very much felt like I was always painting a portrait of what I wanted people in my life to think my life was. And it was so exhausting having to keep up lies. So the song really just speaks to me about how, like, I'm done with that.
You know, in times of struggle,
attempting to leave my cushy government job,
death and my dad getting sick,
relationship drama,
the very first love of my life,
slipped in the fact that he would want an open relationship during brunch.
Bam.
Things do change.
I'm so glad that I found that song.
It just changed my whole outlook. And shut up that little voice that says I can't do it.
I'm not sure where I'll end up, but I'm hopeful and I'm enjoying the ride.
It was such an agent of change for me.
And that song can still make me cry, make me feel brave, and fill my heart with hope.
A quick note here, if you'd like to see what you just heard, you can watch the video that we played on stage on our website at deathsexmoney.org. It features lots of your amazing dance moves. You have no idea how much fun it's been to be sitting at work and you get these dance videos coming into the email inbox. It's been so awesome. Thank you for sharing. I want to give a special shout out to Sherry, who you saw dancing in her car to Jill Scott's Golden with no hands on her steering wheel. She's actually here tonight. Sherry. Thank you. And she's here with her mother, who she was driving to see during those long road trips a few years back. So like Sherry found joy in music during a difficult time, our next guest found her way through a hard moment through art. Amatus is a musician and a producer. And about 10 years ago, she lost her brother. He was shot and killed in his Chicago barbershop during a robbery. And she ended up making art that explored gun violence and its impact in her music and in film. It took many years for her brother's killer to be convicted. And near the end of that long process, she heard from Mahershala Ali, whom she knew during her days as a student at NYU. Mahershala, you know as Remy from House of Cards. Remy! He's also played Boggs in The Hunger Games, or maybe you saw him and his fantastic performance in the recent off-Broadway show Smart People. They got married just a few months after they reconnected, and they now make their home in Bed-Stuy. Please welcome Mahershala Ali and Amatus. So glad you all are here. You have such an interesting story. Mahershala, I want you to take me back to when you were an acting student at NYU and you noticed this woman, Amatus.
Wow.
What do you remember about her at that point?
That's good, because...
Oh, no.
Yeah. See, I wasn't particularly good at talking to women. And so I was in grad school. I was a little bit of a late bloomer. With a lot of things, but so I was in grad school. She was in the undergrad program. I had a friend who also went to NYU, went to undergrad, so he was in ETA at the same studio she was in. You were in ETA, right?
ETW,
sorry.
ETW, what's that stand for?
Experimental Theater Wing.
Yeah. All right.
So
an artist.
The yes. NPR of...
Yeah. Yeah.
So my buddy who had graduated from ETW was the same year as I was in the grad program. So we would be like leaving the building. We were on the fifth floor. The grad students were coming in and out. It's a small program. And I'd see these like this pack of girls who used to kind of like run together. And it was a pack of girls. I'm telling this story. So, and she, you know, she's very much individual. She would be in and out, but she would still be with the pack of girls.
Oh.
And I used to say to Andre, I'd be like, yo, man, Amatus, man. I'd be like, yeah, man, Amatus, brother. So I was just trying
happening.
To figure out how I was going to approach this, considering that I don't talk to women all that well. So you got to know, this is a long time ago. This is 97, so it's not necessarily corny to say. You got to think the poetry slam era. Like, I'm from the Bay Area, so like that.
Cool.
That's a very real thing
You
know. But anyway, so I was like, So I wrote this little poem, and I walked around with that joint in my backpack for like a month. And then finally I ran into Amatus, and it seemed like the appropriate time to give it to her.
Oh, my God.
So I give her this...
On paper?
I give her this poem.
It was a postcard.
Oh.
She says she still has it. I give her this poem... And no response. Like, she doesn't really say anything. I run into her. I'm a little embarrassed about it now because she never mentions it. She goes to London for a year, the year later. Like, we never connect. And then my third and last year of grad school, her senior year of college, ran into a friend of hers, invited her to a show.
Okay, when do I get
reconnect.
To?
Okay, come
so,
on in.
Jump in.
Your turn.
Whatever
Dang.
She says, that's how it really happened.
So what happened
okay,
your
so
senior year and when he was in his third
anyway,
year?
Anyway, he's in a really good-looking guy, right? So, like, literally, he's, like, the most attractive person on the campus. Like, he played basketball in college, and I am a super nerd and a late bloomer as well as most many college students are when you really look at peel that layer back. So I'm like, what? Like, I just didn't even know what to do with that information and didn't even really date that much. And, you know, anyway.
So you got a postcard from the hottest guy on campus and you decided you just couldn't deal.
Ignore me. Literally ignored me. That's cool. It worked out. That's cool.
Anyway, that's like a dissertation, right?
Yeah, it's
you
a
know.
Long story, but it worked out.
So then you both moved on from NYU, and you weren't in touch for many, many years, right?
Like,
like
I ran into her one time, twice. So we saw each other in California one time in like 2001.
One.
And then we saw each other again in like maybe like 2003 at this conference thing, and then we like ran into each other and connected real quick. But after that, we didn't talk for 9, 10 years.
So when you heard from Mahershala after those 9 or 10 years, what was happening in your life, Amatuth?
It's a lot. So I had gone through probably like a total of 3 deaths to gun violence. And I really stepped into a different vortex. And it's one of those cliche examples of you never know what's going to happen in your life. And I'm the only one in my family to go to college, got a full scholarship. I actually went to a private school for high school on a school full scholarship. And so I really was living this dichotomous life that all came crashing to a crazy head and gave me just a lot of information to really pick myself up and really choose a lot of things for my life as well. I grew up in a really religious household and all the other stuff. Anyway, by the time we reconnected, I think I was 1,000% sure about what I truly wanted in my life and had been praying and just doing a whole bunch of things to reclaim a lot of things. And I was, you know, just present and ready to be
guided.
Oh, whoa! Oh! Yeah, to marry a comedian.
When you say you got clearer about what you wanted, what changed?
Really simply, I never really thought I would ever get married, to be honest. And you know, I was just ravenous for information, doing things, I'm here, world, let's keep going. And a lot of my friends are like that too. My parents were divorced, so it just wasn't something that really was on my radar, to be honest. And I wasn't upset about it at all. But when you go through a tragedy or something crazy that like tears your crap up, you then really realize and decide you're not going to take anything for granted. And so it was the first time in my life that I was like, wow, okay, I really can't go through anything serious ever again by myself. Hmm. And it was just something that clicked and was like, yeah, now I know why people get married. One of the reasons. Like, because real stuff be happening. And like,
and
real stuff.
Mahershala, did you have a sense of what was going on in her life when you reached out?
No, I didn't, because we hadn't talked.
Yeah.
But like once we did start talking, I could tell that it was obvious to me that she had been deeply affected by experiences that she had when we first knew each other. But that she was climbing out of something, you know. And I think as we began to talk, because she was in New York and I was in Los Angeles, like we were communicating a lot. We were just talking every day, so there wasn't anything real physical happening.
Wait, so it's like late night phone calls with a 3-hour time difference, that sort
of
thing?
Yeah, and there was just an emphasis on the communication and like really becoming friends, because in most relationships, people are within close proximity to one another, and it becomes about other things very quickly, and things begin to shut down. Like, you don't work as hard to get to know each other. And because we were so far away from each other, and I was busy working and doing my thing or whatever, that it was all about talking. And so I could tell that she was in a period of transition and kind of clearing her slate and getting her head together, as was I. I was just a little bit, I think in that time, I think she would admit that I was just a little bit further along in a certain way, because I was very clear about when I reached out to her, the reason I reached out to her was because I was very clear about where I was at. So I was coming into it with a clean slate.
You were reaching out with very serious intentions.
I was just, yeah, well, I mean, look, I know, yeah. I was like, where are you at, essentially? Like, because what's the point? Like, you're not just running around to be dating, just to be dating. I'm pushing 40. Like,
it was time.
You know, I've done that. Like, this is like, I know she's a serious person. She's extraordinarily intelligent. She's about the right things, spiritually grounded, a beautiful person. So I reached out like, so where are you at in your life? And at a certain point was really upfront about it. But, you know, but still, it's, I could tell she was in a place of transition. So, yeah.
And I want to know a little bit more about how you got to that place, because you went to college on an athletic scholarship initially. Mm-hmm. You played basketball, got kind of turned off by mm-hmm. the culture of college athletics,
yeah.
and then decided to commit your life to theater, to acting.
Right.
How do you think going through that process of college athletics, mm-hmm. playing on a team, but also learning about the commerce of it, how has that shaped the way you think about your work now?
Well, one thing that never totally jived with me with athletics, I grew up playing sports as early as 4 years old. I was competing very seriously. I started in BMX racing and later on got into basketball and all this stuff. But I never really related to that whole thing about beating someone else. That just, it's just not my spirit. And so I played basketball. I'm a goal-oriented person. At least I was for a time. Maybe that shifted, but I could be very driven by goals. And so it became this goal to go to school for free, because otherwise I wasn't going. And so I got a basketball scholarship, and that was great, and my education was paid for. But what spoke to me when I compare the two, what I've learned about it, is that acting is about being your best self. I'm not going to out-act somebody. My work may resonate to you more than the person's work that's standing next to me, but I have to be my best self. And what I love about that is I can take personal responsibility for that. I can control that. But when you start going, when you become competitive and it's about beating someone else, even if you quote-unquote beat them, that doesn't mean that you're your best self. You just did enough to beat them. Hmm. So I'm more so about working my own stuff out and getting down into my own blocks and whatnot and trying to work through those things and live as honestly and truthfully as possible, because I feel like that all carries into your work as well. So, and, you know, but did I kind of answer
yeah.
your question?
Yeah. I see why you are looking out for a spiritually grounded woman. I hear that. So you are both Muslim. You converted when you were a teenager, Mahershala.
I was 25.
25, so you're out of college.
I was in grad school. I was in my last year of graduate school.
What happened?
I had, before we met, so my mom's an ordained minister. My grandmother's an ordained minister. My mother's sister. Like, I come from a very serious pocket of Christians, like hardcore. So yeah, her father, is an imam. So I left home very early. I left home at like 16, moved in with my grandparents. I needed to have, my dad was on Broadway, so my dad was an actor. So my parents are polar opposites, you know, in terms of just how they approach life. Not good or bad, I'm just, they're very different. My father's deceased, but they were very different. So I just needed more space to take in the world, especially being influenced by, like my mom would say, you know, you ain't going to heaven unless you believe in Jesus Christ. My dad would say, Jesus ain't God. Like, you know, so like that was my upbringing. So I needed the space to kind of like come to terms with those things for myself. So in grad school, being in New York, I'm from the Bay Area, I was in New York. It's moving, it's fast. There's like, especially Brooklyn in 97, 2000 is a very different Brooklyn, very conscious, very artistic, and like Black Stars running around and Erykah Badu's down the street and Rosie's over there. Like, you got, Brooklyn is like Spike Lee's Brooklyn still, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's about being awake. And so a person like me who's very porous, I'm taking that in and trying to come to terms with what I'm going through spiritually. And so I began reading some books. And what spoke to me about Islam was that it was the emphasis on God's oneness, and that all men, even Muhammad, were men. They were messengers. Like, they're not to be worshipped.
People.
they're people, you know? And that was one of the things that attracted me. But the biggest thing was I went with her and her mother. First time I went to a mosque. So I go in, we make the prayer. And it's in Arabic. I don't understand a word of it. And I'm kind of following the brothers around, doing all the prostrations and whatnot. And I just start crying. And I was like, what? And I'm not really going through anything in that at that moment. So things are pretty dang good, actually. And I just have this really strong response where this prayer is like resonating in my body and I'm like crying. So that was the first time. I woke up a week later and I get up and I go, I gotta go to the mosque. I just woke up and like, I gotta go to the mosque. Long story short, I converted that day. I called her. I said, I converted. She said, you did what? She said, I converted. I won't say what mosque I did it at. But she goes, where? I said, I went to such and such mosque. She goes, they're crazy over there. What? No, you did not. I was like, yeah. It's like, yes. No, they're crazy. Hold on. So next thing you know, I had these other brothers calling me. And I got taken care of. But yeah.
So Amatrice, I want to ask you. You married in 2013, and it was a time when Mahershala's career is kind of exploding with House of Cards happening. He's in a movie in June, Free State of Jones with Matthew McConaughey. You're going to be in a Marvel superhero show on Netflix, Luke Cage. All of this is happening as your marriage, you know, you're 3 years in. How has your faith together sort of structured how you think about success and dealing with success together? How do you talk about it?
I don't know. We don't have conversations about success in that kind of way. I mean, he's having his own experience with success and what that means for him. And it's amazing to see specifically his career grow. So it's a beautiful thing to see.
Mahershala, does your faith ever feel like it's in tension with Hollywood?
You mean in friction?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Like I have to, when I read projects, when things pop up for me that I feel like are kind of counterintuitive to what the faith requires of me, I have to figure that out a little bit.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Well, for instance, like, you know, there's stuff on House of Cards. They're like, so I don't do simulated sex scenes, right? But I also can't get in the way of the story they want to tell. So it's like, how do we go about doing this and you get what you want and then I don't walk away with just the bunch of just Islam dirt on me? You know what I mean? Just a bunch of just muddy spiritual stuff on me. You know what I mean? Just so I can kind of stay true to my journey and my path, but also not get in the way of the story that needs to be told. It doesn't mean you can't be the love interest. It doesn't mean that you can't be a sexual being in something, but do I need to be like bumping and grinding and doing a bunch of stuff with the girl and flipping her over? Like, nah, I don't really need to be doing that. Yeah. You know what I mean?
You can suggest some other camera angles.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, pan over to the flower shaking. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. You're good.
Mahershala Ali and Amatrice, thank you so much for being here tonight.
Thank you.
It's really nice to meet you. Now, I want to welcome to the stage a woman you know from 20 Feet from Stardom, the Oscar-nominated documentary about backup singers. You also know her for her singular voice. I talked to her on the show about a year ago about growing up right near here in Fort Greene, and also about her feelings about the future after touring for decades with rock stars like the Rolling Stones and Tina Turner. Since that time, she has headlined her own tour with her band Grand Bâton. This is J.C. Maillard, the band leader and guitarist. This is Terry Arpino on percussion and Aidan Carroll on bass. And they have gone all over the place, all over the world with this tour, including stops in New York at the Blue Note and Birdland. In fact, at Birdland, New York Times critic Stephen Holden said they brought down the house in the single best show I've seen in the many years I've been to Birdland. Please welcome, along with her band Grand Bataan, the incomparable Lisa Fisher. That's singer Lisa Fisher and her band Grand Bataan. They rocked it. You can hear their complete performance, including an incredible cover of Led Zeppelin's Rock and Roll, on our website at deathsexmoney.org. Coming up, my conversation with comedian Hari Kondabolu and his mom, Uma Kondabolu. Together on stage, they were delightful.
I feel like a lot of our humor growing up was also making fun of Dad. Like,
when he's not at home.
When he's not. Yeah.
Another thing that happened on stage during this show is I took a live phone call from sex columnist Dan Savage. When he was on the show back in 2014, we talked about monogamy and commitment, and I thought a lot about our conversation before I got married. So now that I'm becoming a parent, I asked him to tell me the hard truth about parenting that no one else has mentioned.
Two people together being parents, that's the original two-party system, and you're going to do this thing Dems and Republicans do, where you automatically leap to the opposite position and passionately cling to it and argue it, even if you hadn't given it a moment's thought in your life before, just because the other person took the other position first. And the problem is, if I can rant for a second, if you don't realize that's what you're doing, it can destroy your relationship.
How long did it take you and Terry to realize that was happening?
It took about a year, almost, maybe a little longer, before we just realized that this isn't who we are and this isn't our relationship. This is Congress. That was
God
the
forbid.
And yeah, we put a label on it, and then we were able to, like, say, Congress is in session, we're going to have this argument, and then we would adjourn Congress, and, you know, it became a game.
And like most conversations with Dan Savage, this one had to end when I still had lots more questions.
We didn't even get to talk about sex after the baby was born.
I will get to that, I promise you. I will call you back. Thanks so much to Dan Savage for giving me a call. We love doing these live events with all of you, and we hope to do even more in the future in lots of different places. You can keep up with all of our plans by subscribing to our weekly newsletter at deathsexmoney.org/newsletter. On the next episode, a woman finds out her husband's been cheating when he's in a coma.
The anger I had was primarily directed towards the woman he'd had the affair with.
Why do you think?
Well, you can't blame the dead guy.
our final guests tonight have been navigating change throughout their entire relationship. When she was in her 20s, Uma Kondabolu was moving away from her home in India, leaving her practice as a physician behind, to move to Queens. And within a few years, she and her husband had two little boys that they were raising in America. The oldest is comedian Hari Kondabolu. When he was growing up, his mother Uma told him he could be whatever he wanted to be as long as he got 2 degrees. So he had one as a backup. Hari has not needed a backup plan. You have seen him on Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell, on Letterman, on his own Comedy Central special. Please welcome Hari Kondabolu and his mother, Uma Kondabolu. Thank you for bringing your mom.
Yeah, this is surreal.
Hari, tell me what growing up in the household with your mom in Queens taught you about comedy.
She's very quick can put
used
me in...
to be.
You're still quick. I mean, I'm not talking about physically. I'm talking about verbally. You're still... See, that's from her. That's the kind of... And so, like, you know, it's funny, like, doing interviews and stuff, I would try to explain, like, you know, like, oh, I probably learned to be funny from watching lots of TV, and my little brother and I are really close, and we go back and forth and stuff, and it's as if I forgot the source has been my mom the whole time. Like, she's very quick, like, witty, sharp, and, like, compared to my father, it's more... My father's, like, unintentionally funny. Like... Like he's like a comic genius without meaning to, because he says absurd things, and my mom and I look at each other and laugh. So, but my mom is actually just really always like spot on quick. So I got that from her.
Yeah. Uma, do you have the same sense of humor as your son, or is it different?
I have more realistic one.
What does that mean?
That means to make situations funny. So that raising two boys, it's not easy. Anything they say, I have to correct them without being sounding harsh. Oh, that's where I come up funny, but I think when they're growing up, they got it. She's being funny, but she's not that funny what she means.
Huh. So it was the way that you kept your boys doing what you wanted to do without seeming like you were being too strict.
Yes.
That's brilliant.
It's sort of giving you one or two lessons. Before.
Yes, thank you.
It's funny because I think, you know, for years I've asked my mom about my stand-up and like, how she feels about it. And I'm like, how much of it do you understand and how much of it do you find funny? And like, how about dad? And she's like, I think I've... find 80%, I understand 80%, I find 40% funny. And your father understands maybe 20%. I'm not sure if he finds any of it funny. And I think for years I thought that she just didn't understand what I did. You know, like I am very verbose, I have long setups, I like to play with structure, and I'll explain, like I'll try out jokes, and what do you think of this, or what do you think of this? And it's like, it's a 3-minute joke about roots that people don't get, but at the end there's a turn. And she's like, I don't think it's funny. I don't think. Or she'll be diplomatic and say, I don't think it's for my generation. Which is her way of saying, me and everyone I know, none of us would find it funny. But... And then I started to realize, you know, it's not that she didn't necessarily find me funny. It's that she has a very different way of thinking about humor. Like, she's about joke economy. Like, that's a term the comedians use to make us sound like we're doing something important. And so, you know, just the idea of, like, let's get to the punchline. Say it quick. Don't waste too many words. Just get right to it. And I was telling my mom this. I'm like, it's not that you didn't get what I was saying or didn't find it funny. It's just you approach things with like a shorter joke economy. And she's like, I don't know about all that. I just don't think you're that funny. So, again, joke economy, cutting right to the point.
Gets right to it. Right. Uma, when you moved to Queens with your husband and you were raising these two little boys. How long did it take you to feel like you were comfortable?
When they are 25. when I saw, okay, they're okay now, they can cross the street.
Mm-hmm. 25 was a big year, huh?
And I'm not comfortable with my husband crossing the street yet. So that's why I'm still in Queens.
Uma, when you were thinking about how you wanted to raise your boys in the U.S., what did you and your husband talk about the, what you wanted them to understand about their heritage?
Any meaningful conversation, I do it to myself in front of the mirror, not to my husband. So Hari is, that's why I think Hari, when he's five, I think I started to talking to him because lack of adult company. So
I should also say that my dad is not a regular listener to WNYC. It's your podcast,
we don't need to feel nervous, okay.
Yeah, we're in a safe place here. He's a very sweet man. Very well-intentioned, whether you want to see that as a euphemism or not. He's very well-intentioned.
Very well-intentioned.
Yeah. Very good father and husband, so to say. But conversation is not his strong point.
The irony in that also is that he talks a lot.
I'm going to move away from your father for a minute. Hari, did you feel a particular responsibility being the oldest son in your household?
Yeah. I mean, I think, and I think a lot of, like, immigrant kids probably have that experience, which I'm sure, like, NPR listeners are like, ooh, tell us about the immigrant experience. Great. Mm. Cultural experience.
Candy. Yeah. Give it
Mom,
to us.
His mom's wearing ethnic garb. Mm, yum. Great. But I do self-awareness also something my mom instilled. Yeah, certainly I think your parents don't know the system. They don't know how to navigate it. I have a younger brother, and I kind of had to be that translator, not like with English, but just in terms of how the system works. And and I think a lot of older kids are the guinea pigs anyway, right? You put us out there, hope we turn out okay. If not, you get a backup. So yeah, I often felt like I was protective of my parents, and also was very aware that, okay, my parents are immigrants, English as their second language, they don't know the system, let me be extra aware of what's going on.
And so, did that shape when you were, say, in college, when you were thinking about your responsibility to your family, how did that shape what you thought you were going to do in the world?
Well, first of all, I felt a lot of guilt for leaving, because I grew up in Queens, and, we live in Queens, and I went to college in Maine, which is very different. And
yes.
Yeah, that's also a euphemism. But I always felt a great deal of, they need me, my brother needs me, my parents need me, and I left. But yeah, I mean, it was really hard to leave. And then when I left, my strength was never math and science. And the idea of me being a doctor was out of the question early on, because whenever I saw blood, I'd pass out. Already I was going on this liberal arts path, which is kind of unconventional. And then I'm like, all right, I'll be a lawyer, because that's the other thing you can do, right? How many things can you do? And then I studied, I was a government major, and then I got really interested in, especially post 9/11, civil rights, human rights, things about justice. And so I had to move them from lawyer to a civil rights or human rights lawyer. But I'm still a lawyer though. So it's still, and that was not a source, there was reluctance there. And then, And then from there, I went to, you know, I went to Seattle. I became an immigrant rights organizer. And then I decided, like, I didn't want to be a lawyer because people kept telling me, "Oh, you have such a nice personality. Why would you be a lawyer?" And so I decided to go to the London School of Economics, so that a human rights program. So I kind of shifted them subtly again. No, not civil rights. I'll just get this master's program that I can start working. And it's still at the London School of Economics, and you can tell your friends I went there. That's great.
Fancy.
And then I started, the comedy took off, and I became like this comic. And at that point, I had shifted their expectations subtly down for years, like gradually lower and lower. And so by the time I took up comedy, like, they were kind of prepared, you know? Like, because, like, comedy and human rights work are kind of equally lucrative. And so there was a pressure, certainly, but then I was smart about how I, you know, broke their hearts really gradually over time, so...
And how do you feel about that responsibility to your family at this point in your life, as you've aged and as your parents are getting older?
Hannah, you're forgetting he's responsible as his son, but we are not invalid. We both are still working.
Yeah. Is that how you feel? Do you feel, like, less guilty about being away?
I mean, that's where my guilt is. Why are they still working? You know, like, it's... You know, like, my brother was a hype man in a rap group, and he writes articles for Vice. There's not a ton of money in that. And he also, he's an artist, and he has an exhibit out. Not a ton of money in that either. And I'm a stand-up comedian, so you know. And, you know, being a successful stand-up comedian is great, but that doesn't mean I have a ton of income to spare. And, you know, it's like a lot of my friends, like, they make a lot of money, and they can... Their parents can retire, and they know that their kids will take care of them. And I'm like, I'm barely taking care of myself, to be honest. So there's those kinds of things where I'm like, I hate the fact my parents are still working. What did I do wrong? How come my parents have two black sheep out of two kids? Like, it's, you know.
No, with all this, seriously speaking, we should work. We are capable. We are still mentally very... it's no point... Why we should sit back and relax when you can do something for the society or whatever you are used to. We both are in medical profession. What do I do sitting home? Make two more curries for my husband? it doesn't make any sense.
And when you hear Hari talk about that feeling of guilt, do you feel like, oh, I wish he didn't feel that way, or do you think it's healthy?
Occasional guilt is good. But I tell them they don't need to feel that. I'm very proud of what they chose to do. And being an artist, choose to be an artist is not easy. He knows that he's going against grain. And which I told him that, be careful. Me wanting him to have education as a backup piece, he's choosing something which... none of the Indians went before. And then color, and this is like, even though we all say politically it's not right to bring race into everything, but obviously it is.
Yeah.
So I just want him to feel secure enough. Oh, okay, if this is not working, I can be a teacher or whatever, to the point he can get.
Teaching is a great profession, Mom, and people do... You have to know this audience, Mom,
yes.
Honestly. I mean, it's I mean, you know, I've thought about that, Mom, but, like, honestly, I haven't been in a workplace in, like, a decade. Like, I barely know how to use Excel. Like, it's like... So, you know.
You know, when you are hungry for a week, you learn.
Yeah, right.
Hari, I want to ask you about romance.
Oh, my God.
Your mother had a different experience with marriage than you have had.
Yeah.
Their marriage was an arranged marriage.
Yes.
What has it been like to introduce women to your parents?
I mean, I don't think the arranged marriage part, if, you know, really has an impact with that.
It might come to that at one point. the way he's going, it doesn't look like anybody around.
I set her up for that. I'm sorry.
Oh, this was such a good idea, Anna. This was such a good idea. I mean, I think people have a pretty easy time with my folks. I mean, my parents are really easy to get along with. They're fun. My dad, like, his expectations are just like, oh, somebody's listening to me. This is great. Somebody's asking me questions about my life and not making fun of me. Like, you know, like, and, you know, my mom has always treated anyone, whether it's friends or partners or potential partners, like, she's always treated them with, like, the utmost respect and love. So that has never been particularly hard. Yeah.
You've talked about a subtle pressure about grandchildren.
Subtle, okay.
And I don't want to ask about that. What I'm more curious is about the other relationships in your life. And when you think about what you learned from your parents and how you treat people,
yeah.
How have what you learned from your parents affected your work relationships?
Certainly, my parents, like, they put their head down. They work extremely hard. Like, my dad, he basically worked 7 days a week. He had his main job, but he also had a bunch of side jobs. He worked Saturdays and Sundays. Like my father said he was slowing down a couple of years ago, which meant he was just doing his regular job, like his 9-to-5 job, you know? So, like, that kind of hard work and constantly grinding it out. My father also, like he's a smart man, but I think one thing I learned was just how he makes connections with people. He, like, genuinely cares about people. He, like, you know, those kinds of relationships. Both my parents are really good at, like connecting with human beings regardless of background. And that was one part, you know, growing up in Queens also, that's a useful thing to, you know, to have. Like, it'd be terrible if they were bigoted. Like, what a waste of Queens. But that was certainly something that as something I've always been able to adjust to where I am and be okay because of that. And also, I know how to stand up for myself. And my folks were never big in terms of, like, you know, go against the system, you know, break rules. They weren't that type. But, like, they, in subtle ways, like, they would speak up for themselves, whether it was at work or with other people. They didn't let people push them around. And I think, especially as immigrants, as accented immigrants, even in New York, I saw moments where people were trying to push my parents around, treat them poorly, and they wouldn't take it. Whether it was subtle or over the top, they wouldn't take it. So for me, I feel like in work situations, you know, I work hard, I keep my head down, I do the job, I'm focused. But when I know I'm being taken advantage of, you know, I'm not subtle about it. You know, I speak up for myself.
Yeah. And Luma, did you realize you were teaching your sons that?
Yes. Yes. When I went to a post office once, I'm giving an example. When Hari brought that up, I thought my both kids were with me. At that point, I didn't start working because I wanted to raise them myself up to, they started schooling or up to 5 or something. So I used to wear saris and go around. This is my dress. So he saw me like this. I said stamps and whatever. Maybe I didn't speak.
You mean the clerk? Sorry.
The clerk. Yeah. And then I didn't raise my voice because I speak softly. And then he raised his voice and asked, "What do you want?" And then he said it repeatedly as if I didn't understand what he was asking. First 2 times I repeated it, and then it became a game with him, I thought, after the 3rd time. And then I said, "I don't know about you, but I understand what you are speaking. I think you have a problem understanding English." So I want this, this, this. If you want any more clearer, I can write it to you if you have pen and paper. So then I just kept quiet, and he looked at me a little bit embarrassed, I think. Both my children looked up, and they looked at each other. I thought, got it.
Hari Kondabolu has a new comedy album coming out in a few months called Mainstream American Comic on the Killer Rock Stars label. Uma Kondabolu, thank you so much for
thank
being
you,
here.
Anna,
what
for
a pleasure
us.
To
thank
have you,
you
here together. Thank you. they so great? I want to tell you one more way we are going to put the incredible music list that we've put together to use. We decided we needed to have a dance party. So in 3 weeks, on April 2nd at the Brooklyn Museum, we are partnering with them on First Saturday, and we are having an Anthems of Change dance party at 9 p.m. It's free, and all of you are invited. Information is on our website at deathsexmoney.org. I will be on the dance floor. The team will be on the dance floor. We hope all of you will be on the dance floor because it's going to be great. But of course, some of the songs that have gotten us through our hardest moments are not dance numbers. And I want to tell you about one that's been important in my life. I first heard it when I was about 9 or 10 years old, and I was at the beach with my family. And my oldest sister, Liz, was home from college, and she had this mixtape that was like this black plastic cassette. And about halfway through, on one of the sides, was this song, Que Sera Sera. And most of you might know the Doris Day version.
Que Sera Sera, whatever will be, will be.
That was not the version on my cool older sister's mixtape. She had the version by Sly and the Family Stone, which is all groove and aching for answers.
When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Here's what she
good, right? So I made my sister play that song over and over and over again, and we had to rewind it to just the right spot on the cassette each time. But for some reason, I didn't get a copy of it for myself until the summer after my freshman year of college, and I was on a road trip with my friend Megana, and we rented the cheapest compact car that was legal to drive on the road. It was like made out of flimsy plastic. But it had a CD player. So we called it the Stereo with Wheels. And on our way out of town, we stopped at a Best Buy, and I'm digging through the discount bin, and I find the best of Sly and the Family Stone. And track 20 is Que Sera Sera. And we listened to that song on repeat throughout that whole road trip. Fast forward to this winter, and I'm in my apartment, and I'm just at that stage in pregnancy when your body hasn't changed that much, so you're feeling really excited about the news, but also in total denial about how much is about to change. And I was reading a baby book, and I read that just about that point, the baby was starting to be able to hear things around it. It was time for the parents, they recommended, to start talking to the baby and singing to the baby. And I thought, oh my God, this is amazing. This baby can hear. And then I thought, oh, what is this baby overhearing? I have not been thinking about this. And you know my show. You know what we talk about. And then I started thinking, oh, well, maybe I'll just start singing to it. And so I'm thinking, and I'm trying to think of a lullaby from when I was a kid. And I can't remember the words to any of them. Like none. But I do remember the three simple verses from Sly and the Family Stone. So I'm alone in my apartment, and I start singing. And I get to the third verse, which is when that little girl has grown up, and she has children of her own, and her child comes to her and says, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? And the mother says, Que sera, sera, whatever will be, will be. The future's not ours to see. And I always heard it as a mother reassuring a child. So nice and lovely, this passing of wisdom from one generation to the next. But as I'm singing in my apartment and I'm like looking down at this mystery, I'm hearing it in a different way for the very first time. I'm hearing it as this mother trying to reassure herself that she's like looking into the face of this child, and all she wants is to make it feel loved and safe in the world. And I'm realizing I don't know how to do that. And I'm wondering, how is any of this going to fit into my life? How is this going to work? I don't know what I'm doing. And I don't like feeling like I don't know what I'm doing. But it is comforting to get to ask family, my partner Arthur, my sex columnist friends on the phone, how they've gotten through hard times, and to hear how you've gotten through hard times. It does, it really helps me.
Sex and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios. The team includes Katie Bishop, Chester Jesus Soria, Emily Botine, and Hannah McCarthy. Our engineers at BAM were Irene Trudell, Ed Haber, and Rick Kwan. Special thanks to Rachel Dickstein, Alana O'Hagan, Stephanie Billman, Melissa O'Donnell, Josh Higgison, John Morris, Bob Wuss, and the whole team at BAM. The Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. The band Grand Baton performed that theme song and all of the other music during this live show, along with the great Lisa Fisher. You can hear the full version of her performance of this song on our website at deathsexmoney.org. And because the message of Que Sera Sera is one we can all identify with, we had to end the evening all together with one final chorus.
Sing it, come on, sing it all together.
Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money. Good night.